This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. These two sentences from a study by Johannes Haushofer at Princeton University tell you a lot about why poverty is such an intractable global problem. They read, "An environment of poverty into which one happens to have been born can trigger processes that reinforce poverty. On this view, any one of us might be poor if it were not for certain environmental coincidences." The findings of this study and many others present a convincing conclusion that the situation of poverty leads to high levels of stress, and that stress can cause everything from chronic health problems to stunted brain development, and can contribute to poor decision-making. Over the last few years, we've been taking a close look at health equity here on WNPR and how race and economic disparity can lead to problems in mental and physical health. Today, we will dig into some of the science of poverty, how it affects the brain, and what can be done to break the cycle. You can join us as always, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can also comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining me first is Kathleen Weldon. She's research manager for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. But she took part in a study that got us thinking about this, The Burden of Stress in America. It was done by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate your time, and welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us about the questions that you were asking in this study about stress and health.
Well, we were very interested in health and stress, the relationship both in terms of health issues causing stress and health issues being caused by stress. So we had a number of questions about the things that people saw as contributing to their stress and the things that people saw as the outcome of their stress. And we looked at that particularly by the people who said that in the last month they had a great deal of stress. So we were looking at stressed people in the immediate last month, they're feeling it. What did they see as the relationship?
So maybe you can tell us some of the findings, some of the things that you learned from what you heard from people.
Well, we found that health was huge. When we looked at the people who were under a great deal of stress in the last month, we found people were more likely to say that they were if they were poor, in poor health, had a chronic illness, were disabled, or also were a parent of a teenager or a single parent. So we had these groups that were showing particularly high levels of stress. But even when you get down into the groups and start comparing them within those who say they have a great deal of stress, if you look at people who are poor, they also show higher levels of response to stress and higher numbers of contributors to stress. So even compared to wealthier people who are also under a great deal of stress, those who were poor said that their own health problems caused them stress in the last month. Their family health problems caused them stress in the last month. Problems with friends, problems with finances, which may be obvious. Being unhappy with the way you look was a bigger issue for people who were poor. And when it came to the results of that stress, people who made less than $20,000 were more likely to say it made it harder for them to manage a chronic illness or disability if they had one, that it gave them muscle pains, back aches, that it kept them from taking care of their family members the way they wanted to, that it made it harder for them to get along with their friends, that the stress in their lives was having serious effects throughout multiple realms of their life. And they could see it. It was very clear to them.
One of the things that we've talked a lot about, given the economic downturn of the last couple of years, is that many people who previously did not consider themselves poor or in poverty or in financial dire straits now find themselves in that position. I'm wondering if your survey took a look at that issue, because there's a condition of chronic poverty, people who are born poor and live their lives poor and the stresses that may cause. And then there are people who find themselves in a situation where now I don't have the things I once had.
Yes, that's true. And it's very hard to drill into that in a poll. I think that's why we were a little surprised that the financial problems, if you say what contributed to your stress in the last month, you don't need to be poor to have financial stress. If you have a $400,000 home that is getting where you can't pay the mortgage and the bank is taking it, you're going to be under stress. So we expected to see perhaps a little less of the clear differentiation that the poorest people were the ones who were really suffering from the stress. I think there's also this image that we have of the stressed out stockbroker, right? Mm. The person who has a high power job and, you know, goes home at the end of the day and just can't relax. And that's not what we were seeing. What we were seeing were people who had serious, serious problems. And we saw this relationship with health where people who had health problems were more likely to say they had financial problems. People who had financial problems were more likely to say they had health problems. And within their families, health problems of other family members. And so we started referring to it as the triangle, the health, stress, poverty triangle.
Mm. And this idea of a triangle is interesting. I mean, I referred to it even as a poverty cycle. And I think one of the things we think about in society of a cycle of poverty is you're born poor and then you give birth to someone who then is poor, who then gives birth to someone who is poor. But what you're talking about is a tightly woven cycle, it seems, within even one's life, where the episode of your life that causes you all this stress then reinforces some things that are bad for your health, which reinforces more stress, which reinforces more poverty. It's a terrible cycle to break.
Absolutely. One of the things we found is that people who are under a great deal of stress, we asked them some of the effects, the immediate effects that they might see in their daily life. And the thing that came out more than anything else was it disrupts their sleep. Mm. They sleep less. 70% of people who are under a great deal of stress in the last month said they got less sleep. They also, interestingly enough, 41% said they slept more. So it's not that they just don't sleep for the month. It's that their sleep cycles get disrupted and they may have different responses at different times depending on the form that the stress is taking. They also were likely to say that they ate less and that they ate more. So their healthy patterns get disrupted. They said that they exercise less as a result of the stress. So if you're dealing with a situation where poverty is making you stressed, stress is causing you to not take care of your health in the way you want to, again, can't manage my chronic disease the way I should, then you're building the health problems. But again, we see your health problems and your family's health problems cause you stress. So yes, we could see a cycle very clearly in this sort of very basic asking people how they feel. They could see it themselves.
We're talking with Kathleen Weldon, who's research manager at the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. While she was at the Harvard School of Public Health, she worked on a study that NPR and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation put together, The Burden of Stress in America. And we're talking about stress and poverty today on the program. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. One of the researchers who's been looking at this is Johannes Haushofer. He's an assistant professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He co-authored On the Psychology of Poverty with Ernest Fehr. He joins us today on the phone from Germany. And Professor Haushofer, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
You've just heard from your colleague here, Kathleen Weldon, who's taking a close look at what people who are in poverty say about their health, what they say about stress. You've been looking at this very closely. First of all, I guess I'll just ask you, having heard what she just said, how much of this resonates with the work that you're doing?
It resonates greatly with what I've been doing, and what I think is really lovely about Kathleen's study is that it makes explicit one of the possible channels, one of the variables that come between poverty and stress. So, you know, with the studies that I've done suggest that poverty causes stress, and I've tried very hard to establish that in every which direction and demonstrate causality. But what I really haven't done so far is say which channels that operates through. So what is it that poverty affects that actually does lead to stress? And Kathleen sort of makes explicit the different variables that are contributors. Financial stress is a big one, but health is also an important one. And so that's really wonderful to see this breakdown into the different categories that are affected by poverty and that then cause stress.
To tell us more about the details of your work, of what exactly you studied and what your conclusions were.
So what I've tried to do so far is mainly just nail down the causal link between poverty and stress, and then secondly also, that's my second big interest, between stress and economic decision-making. And one of the ways in which I've tried to establish a causal link between poverty and stress is to look at income shocks in Kenyan farmers. And what we did there is we used a little trick that economists often use, which is the fact that rainfall is broadly a random variable. and it affects the incomes of farmers, but not the incomes of non-farmers. And so we looked at periods of low levels of rainfall and compared them to periods with high levels of rainfall, and we found that farmers, but not non-farmers, were much more stressed when it didn't rain, and they consequently had lower levels of income. So that's one study that looked at the effects of decreases in income on stress levels. Another study that we did, this was a collaboration with my co-author Jeremy Shapiro, looked at the effects of increases in income, so decreases in poverty on stress levels. And this was in the context of a program by a new charity called GiveDirectly, whose mission is to send unconditional cash transfers, so money without strings attached, to poor households in Kenya. And we studied this program in a randomized field experiment in Kenya and found that people who got the money had greatly reduced levels of stress, depression, as well as in some treatments the stress hormone cortisol.
So this idea of the impact that stress has on someone's economic decision-making, their ability to get out of the situation that they're in, this is, I think, something that's fascinating. It's been written about widely, and we've been reading about it in The Atlantic and at NPR in the course of the last several months. I'm wondering if you can talk more about that, because that's one of the, I think, important things for policymakers, people who deal with poverty on an everyday basis from a lawmaking standpoint, to really grapple with. So what can you tell us about that?
So I think there's two interesting ways in which stress can affect economic outcomes and poverty in particular. The first is that it's an undesirable outcome in its own right. And so to the degree that your concept of poverty includes well-being more broadly, just by virtue of stress being a result of poverty, that's already a bad outcome. But secondly, it's turned out in recent years that the stress that's caused by poverty also has knock-on effects on economic decision-making more narrowly defined. So something that I found in my research is that stress causes people to focus more on the present than on the future. So when you offer them a choice between a smaller amount of money available now versus a larger amount of money available later, they're much more likely to choose a small amount of money when they're stressed. And so this is an additional way in which stress can affect poverty, over and above the fact that stress in itself is just a bad outcome in its own right.
So as you take a look at these very important findings, if you could communicate something to lawmakers, to decision makers, about how we deal with the issues of poverty and health, poverty and psychology, and certainly poverty and economic decision making, what are some conclusions you as a person have made about all this, and what would you tell people who try to make policy around this?
I think there's one greatly understudied area whose importance we should understand, and that is the importance of alleviating stress for economic well-being. So the way that people have generally addressed stress and depression is by simply trying to find ways to ameliorate it and then measure that in terms of stress and depression symptoms. What we haven't really studied in enough detail, to my mind, is what the economic effects of those interventions are. And so what I would like to see policymakers put more emphasis on than they have been is understanding the economic benefits of alleviating stress and depression. So intervening on depression, for instance, with cognitive behavioral therapy or something like that, we need to understand better what the economic benefits of doing that are. And once we know that, those interventions can become a tool in our arsenal, not only to cure depression, but also to alleviate poverty.
And this is interesting, Kathleen Weldon, I think, in the idea that of all this, these cycles that we talk about, or these triangles that we talk about, another one is the ability to seek care for the stress, the depression, the physiological problems that come from it. Often people in a lower economic category aren't as easily able to find the medical or psychological help that they need. And this is, I think, part of what Johannes is getting at, is from a policymaker standpoint, the ability to take care of that problem is something I think that's very key.
Sure. I mean, not from this study in particular, but in polling done by the Kaiser Family Foundation particularly, consistently it's been shown that people who are poor have less access to health care and to mental health care. and that is clearly a serious problem. But we also found when we asked people what they did to deal with their stress that about fair numbers did things that we would consider very good choices. You know, they ate better. They spent time outdoors. They meditated or prayed. They did these things that you would like to see people doing, you know, more than 50%. And most of them tried to do something. And almost everyone who did something said it was pretty effective. Mm. People found that you don't do something if you don't think it's going to work. So people who would do these things said, yeah, that helped. But if you look at the top two that people said were the most effective things among those who actually did them, they were spending time outdoors and spending time in a hobby. Those things brought down your stress. And being poor in America, spending time outdoors and spending time in a hobby are not necessarily things that you're going to be able to do.
And Johannes Haushofer, before I let you go, I think that that's a key thing here. The very things that may help people break this cycle, the very things that may help to lower levels of stress and depression are exactly the things that are not available to most poor people in America or the world.
Yes, I think that's the insidious thing about this feedback loop. And I think what's going to be important for policymakers in the future is to think about different places to intervene to break that cycle. And you can think of three obvious places to do that. The first is poverty itself, so alleviating poverty directly through things like cash transfers. I think that debate deserves to be revisited even in the U.S. The second would be to address stress directly through things like simple psychotherapy. And the third is to address economic decisions that might be impaired as a consequence of stress. And that can be done through small behavioral nudges, like commitment savings devices and things like that. So yes, I think this is a very vicious feedback loop, and we should spend more time thinking about where we can break it.
Johannes Haushofer is an assistant professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He joined us by phone today. Thank you so much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Kathleen Weldon. She's from the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. We're also going to be joined by folks who will talk about cognitive behavior therapy, about how to break this cycle of poverty and stress and health. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking about the psychology and the physiology of poverty. We're looking at studies that suggest a strong link between being poor and high stress levels and all the bad health outcomes that can come along with it. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We're joined in studio today by Kathleen Weldon. She's from the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut, but she took part in a survey called The Burden of Stress in America. It was done with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard School of Public Health. We're going to be joined now by Elizabeth Babcock. She's president and CEO of Crittenden Women's Union, and she studies this issue as well. Elizabeth Babcock, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you.
We've been talking about some of the real effects that we've learned about poverty and stress levels, but one of the things you look at is that poverty actually changes the way our brains are wired, the way our brains work. Tell us about that.
Well, there's evidence that shows that children who grow up in poverty develop different neurological wiring in the brain around the areas of decision-making, problem-solving, multitasking, short-term memory that basically set them behind other children in terms of their future ability to persist and attain goals, and that this is further complicated as they grow up if they continue to live in environments of high stress. And even if adults haven't grown up with those kind of childhoods, we know that the impacts of stress on decision-making are quite profound. So we, as an organization, work with low-income families directly trying to help them move out of poverty, and we see the challenges that our families face in these decision-making processes because of their childhoods and because of the current circumstances of their lives.
Why is it so important to make sure people understand that this actually is a brain physiology problem, that this is something that impacts the way people grow up and the way they're wired, as opposed to just a lot of what we've been talking about, which is it so seriously affects the world in which people live, but maybe not necessarily the way their brain works. Why do you think it's so important to get across this message?
Well, I think it's important in particular because it certainly gives a physiological basis to what we see as the challenges that our families in my organization and in other organizations face. But also what's so wonderful about what we're learning about this physiology is that the decision-making skills that we are all talking about today are housed in a part of the brain that is particularly plastic. And actually new neurology in those areas of the brain can be built and are built, have been shown to be built, through coaching mechanisms that encourage practice of delay of gratification, problem-solving, future orientation of goals, and persisting toward those goals. So when families are given an active environment in which they can begin to shift the way they are doing their decision-making, the families can build stronger and stronger skills in this area that relate actually to new neurological wiring.
To tell us a bit more about the work that you do to actually try to train people to make better decisions, because clearly the science shows that people are going to make, you know, more short-term decisions if indeed they're stressed, if they're in poverty. So how do you begin to change that?
Well, the new work of helping families move out of poverty is really being informed by people like Dr. Weldon and Dr. Haushofer. And what we as organizations do with this kind of research is we begin to look at basically three ways of changing how we work. The first is how we create environments in which the families that we're engaging with are more free of stress. So how do we create those environments of service delivery that are taking stress into consideration and actively working to create environmental changes that are less distracting, that are more more able to promote engagement, that have easier access so that the actual rules of engaging, you know, getting to an office or doing a renewal of an eligibility for a public service, that we're decreasing the barriers and the added stress load to families in our own processes and procedures. The next thing we think about is how to give families special tools that can help them deal with the organizational challenges and the kinds of daily challenges for decision-making that they have to make. So special new tools like prompting people with reminders, providing them with organizational tools for their homes or their own bookkeeping or banking, or it's like organizing bins for your clothing, thinking about putting a plan together for what your household is going to be doing the next day, helping families regularize, routinize their household routines, things of that nature, opt out things like plans for helping families save money where it's an automatic process of saving so that they don't face that daily decision, should I save or should I not, but actually the saving happens first and they have to change their mind to opt out of it. Those kinds of rules and tools can help families proceed to their goals in a way that is facilitated. And then the third category of what we do is actually coaching around the decision-making itself to build the problem-solving skills, to build the multitasking skills, to build the future orientation of families. And that kind of coaching we do if we're able to engage with families intensively over time. And my organization, fortunately, is able to do that with families.
You know, I want to get back in just a moment as we bring in another guest to some of these personal changes you work on with people and the tools and coaching. But I just want to get back to this first level, this idea of the environment of service delivery. We've spent quite a bit of time here talking about breakdowns in our system here in the state of Connecticut around our Department of Social Services, where if you were to call the DSS, you may wait on hold for 45 minutes or an hour. We're told often that people who don't have phone minutes on their cell phone actually run out of minutes waiting online to try to get the services that they need. This easier access that you're talking about is so very important. And it seems as though often, Beth, our systems are set up to do two things: to try to provide services for people with the least possible cost, meaning there's often not enough people to provide those services, but also there seems to be a built-in level of an assumption of fraud, that somehow or other we need to make poor people jump over hoops to get the thing that we're going to give them, and those very hoops might keep them from getting better, from getting healthier.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, of course, and one of the things that's really important about what you just said is talking about trying to deliver services in a way that are as cost effective as possible. And when we measure as a public policy, you know, folks designing public policy, when we measure cost, we think about it in terms of the amount of time that has to be spent and the computer systems and those things. We don't think about the downstream costs of these complications in people's lives, raising the stress that inhibits their decision making, that creates this incredible catch-22 of poverty where you can't get out because you can't free up the bandwidth, you can't optimize your decision making because the very services that are providing your safety net are complicating your life. And the costs of that are very high. I mean, we've measured the costs of the public safety net services that our families receive. And we know as a nation now that almost one in four American citizens have an income-related subsidy of some kind, meaning it's a subsidy because of your being below income. And these costs are going up. The safety net costs are going up, and the costs in second-generation perpetuation of this trap of poverty are going up. And when we build our systems, we aren't thinking about those costs because we don't have a future orientation either.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about poverty and stress, poverty and health, what can be done to break a cycle here? Nancy is calling from North Branford. Hello, Nancy.
Hi. I'm a first-time caller. Thanks.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about this topic in relation to the quality of education. And I think that education reformers feel like things like the Common Core and standardized tests and charter schools are going to cure poverty. I think that alleviating poverty will improve education because it will help children's brains to develop better, and when they start school, they'll be able to learn. And I've read that on all standardized tests, like the SAT, ACT, international tests, all different kinds of standardized tests, it's always poorer children who score lower than more affluent children. And that's taken everything else into consideration, like the schools that they go to and the states that they come from, whether or not they have a strong standardized curriculum or not.
Yeah.
So I think that poverty... alleviating poverty will improve education.
Well, and let me, Nancy, you raise such a great point. Thank you for your phone call. I want to put that back to Beth Babcock. A story that we hear often is a child who comes to school who's maybe living with a grandmother because the father's not there. The mother is not available or has terrible health problems. There's violence in the neighborhood. Maybe there's addiction in the family. And you start to hear all of these things and you wonder, my goodness, I couldn't imagine taking a standardized test or even showing up at class if I was dealing with that level of stress. I think what Nancy's saying is often in the education system, we're saying if we just educate our kids better, they'll be smarter and they'll do better and they'll get better jobs and we'll break the cycle. But I think she's saying, and a lot of what our other guests are saying today, is it's awful hard to learn when you got all this other stuff going on in your life.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Nancy is absolutely right, and there's a lot of what part of this brain's new evolution of brain science is helping us to understand is that, and in fact, scientists will now say, IQ is more a measure of one's life experience and exposure to environmental circumstances than it is an actual measure of inherent capability or knowledge. So when what they're saying when they say that is that, you know, that a child who has a lower IQ than another child is the highest reason for that difference in IQ is not genetics, but is actually the life experience and the current circumstances of that child. And that's, I think, a breakthrough kind of framework that is very helpful for those of us who want to think about tackling this entrenched poverty in new ways.
Let me bring into the conversation Kia Levy, who is project director of the New Haven Moms Partnership, to talk about a bit of the work that they're doing. And Kia, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Maybe you can explain what the Moms Partnership is and what work you do to address some of these issues we're talking about today.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So greetings to all my colleagues on the phone. And much of our work is related and contextualized in much of what has already been said today on the phone. All this work is so intricately related. And the New Haven Moms Partnership, we are collaborative in New Haven, based in the Yale School of Medicine, and we partner with a variety of community-based and government organizations throughout the city of New Haven and state of Connecticut to support the well-being of mothers as the entry point into families, and mothers and families who are living in poverty, who are low income, as we've been talking so much about in this program this morning. And we focus on mothers as the entry point to the family because we find that when families are living beneath a certain level of income, that the primary head of household often is the mother for a variety of reasons, for the receipt of benefits and services, you know, for housing, public housing and subsidy stipulations, for whatever the reason, or we find that moms are the entry point into the families. And so MOMS is an acronym. It stands for the Mental Health Outreach to Mothers. And we look at compromised mental and emotional health and wellness of moms as the primary caregiver and entry point into family, and how their mental and emotional health is impacted by stress, and stress that is brought on through the challenges of poverty. And as the doctor was talking earlier about looking at stress as a point in time, or you know, a major stressful event that happened, you know, within a certain time, we're looking at stress that occurs consistently and persistently over a lifetime and over the course of multiple generations in a family's life, and the impact that that has on symptoms of depression, on symptoms of anxiety, on instances of trauma that are triggered, and how that impacts many of the things that Beth Babcock has just described, you know, how you show up at a doctor's office, how you show up in your child's classroom, how you're able to obtain and sustain employment, how do you apply for benefits when you're struggling with a compromised mental health due to this chronic and persistent stress that is occurring in your life. The work of the Moms Partnership is grown out of research done by a professor here at Yale University, Dr. Megan Smith, who's in the Department of Psychiatry at the School of Medicine, who administered a needs assessment over the last 2 years to moms or other primary caregivers in the city of New Haven, and that looked at causes and factors of stress and how it was impacting the mental and emotional health of mothers and women in New Haven, and found that, you know, one of the hugest needs or the hugest factors contributing to overwhelming amounts of persistent and consistent stress is lack of basic needs being met. So 48% of our mothers that we interviewed reported that they run out of food before the end of the month, right? And this is something that's happening in their lives consistently and persistently. But when you're worried about how to feed your family, and you're worried about how you're being perceived as a caregiver, as a mother, when you have multiple challenges that are similar to this one, well, of course you're going to be stressed. And then, of course, that stress is going to impact your mood or your participation in daily life activities and functions. And so what we do is pay attention to that information that we have collected from mothers in New Haven, and we're creating responses and interventions and tools for moms in New Haven to be able to, one, understand how these circumstances are impacting their life, impacting their mental, emotional health, and then what are some tools that we can help support them around and build some skill with them to be able to manage in a different way, very much like Beth has described to you in the earlier part of this conversation.
And we're going to bring in some folks to join the conversation who are calling us at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. I just want to quickly ask Kathleen Weldon this idea of being able to get through a month, actually able to feed yourself, your children. This gets into this feedback loop we were talking about earlier, an inability to get high-quality food, a stress level to try to get that food in your neighborhood. This all plays into some of the stresses that people are telling you about in their lives, the very things that make it so hard to even get up every single day and you know, feed your family, to do the things you need to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. The you know, when you see 70% of people making less than $20,000 a year are saying that in the last month they had problems with finances, that was affecting them and it caused them a great deal of stress, That's a big number. I mean, that's just the last month. So it's not that they're getting by and, yes, they have problems when a big thing happens. That indicates that there's some serious constant problem.
I want to get to a quick phone call. Janine is calling from Farmington. Hello, Janine. Hi, Janine. Are you there? We're just going to put Janine on hold for one quick second and go to David in Hartford. Hello, David.
Hello. I just wanted to share my experience. It may take a moment, but I'll try to be quick.
Yeah.
My wife and I both went to grad school at Yale, but we were in arts-related fields. And so we got married right after graduation. And for our first 4 years of marriage, we lived under the poverty line in a bad neighborhood without a car. And I never would have understood what it's like, a little bit, to have to walk a mile in the snow with a cart to do laundry, to not be able to get fresh produce, to hear gunshots almost every night. We even saw a murder from our third floor apartment, to have drug dealers on our street that I would nod to every evening when I came home from what work I was getting. And we subsequently went on and we're okay now, we have employment and we had education. However, I think a lot of policymakers have never had this sort of experience, and even people in affluent situations in this whole country, they make comments like, well, these people should have more personal responsibility, or they should take they should be held accountable for their actions, so forth. But it's very hard when you have to take a bus and the person next to you is sneezing on you and the other person is threatening you and you can smell the liquor on his breath. I've had to go to legal aid and to the police station to file reports because during that period I was nearly attacked several times just in that neighborhood. And so, yeah, it was tremendously difficult, and I'm sure that my experience is nothing compared to a child who's born there and has to grow up.
Well, David,
but I would just like to urge people to really believe that it is very stressful and it is difficult, even if you haven't personally gone through it. It really is harder than it looks.
David, thank you very much for sharing your story and for talking with us about this today. And Beth Babcock, I think David raises one more point that we haven't really gotten to yet, which is we've seen studies in the past. Children who grow up in areas of poverty, yes, they have the stress of their parents dealing with this. That, yes, they have their own stresses, but they often see very traumatic events as well. They see violence on a regular basis. They see things that the rest of us may never see, and they're seeing them over and over again by the ages of 3 and 5 and 6. And this can indeed have an impact on the way the brain's wired as well.
Absolutely. The physiological impact of stress is one that is related to the chronicity of the stress. So moderate stresses that continue over time that are at a high enough level to sort of elevate the body's cortisol levels, our hormonal levels, which is our body response to stress. If it happens over a continuing period of time, it has a physiological impact on health and also on neurological wiring. And in addition to that, if you experience short duration but highly traumatic events, the impacts are also severe and can be quite long lasting. And I want to just take a second to build out of what your last caller just said, and that is that he highlights, of course, a period in his life where he was living under these circumstances, and then says that they got graduated, they got jobs, and they moved on to be able to have a different lifestyle. And that's a key element here, because we're not only talking about people living under these circumstances, but we're talking about them not having a way out. Because in the past, the way out was for people to get connected to a good-paying job, and those jobs were available for people with limited education. But the families in poverty, the vast majority of low-income families are people who do not have advanced education. And in our society today, there are very few jobs that pay a family-sustaining wage that are a ticket out of poverty that can be obtained without at least a couple of years of education beyond high school. Mm. And so that even loads more on our families, because essentially they're in that hamster wheel, and the way out is for them to get a better paying job. But the way to the better paying job is to load additional stresses on the family of going to school and seeking a career path that is different from perhaps many of the people around them. And that is a challenge that is just a very, very high bar challenge that we have to help our families navigate if they are going to get out of the circumstances that they're in.
And I have to let Beth Babcock go now to take a break, but I want to thank you so much. Beth Babcock is president and CEO of Crittenden Women's Union, who joined us by phone today. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
And thank you also to Kia Levy, who's project director of the New Haven Moms Partnership. When we come back, we're going to take a look at another study about some of these issues we've been talking about today and take some more of your phone calls here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, research shows that using your vacation time can have major benefits. For one, it's better for productivity, and as one study shows, it can even be better for your health. But are Americans taking enough time off, or are we really a no-vacation nation? We'll look at the vacation deficit disorder on tomorrow's program. Today, we're talking about something that's in many ways connected. We're talking about poverty and the brain. We're talking about poverty and stress. The fact is, people who can't take vacations often have really bad health outcomes. They're trying to chase around money. They're trying to get out of the situation they're in, and it's often very, very bad for their health. We've talked about a number of studies and surveys today so far, but I want to bring in Erica Skoy, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at the University of Connecticut, to talk about another study. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about what you're studying.
So we've heard today that the science is pretty clear that if you grow up in poverty, you're at an increased risk of being exposed to stresses as well as other environmental factors that can compromise how the brain is wired and developed and functions, and that the systems that seem to be most affected in the brain are the cognitive systems as well as language systems. And the research that I'm involved in is interested in another facet that may also be compromised by socioeconomic impoverishment, and that's specifically how sensory systems in the brain may be compromised. So how the brain is able to take information from the environment, so specifically sound, and capture that information and faithfully represent it. And in the study that I was a part of, it was a collaboration with Northwestern University as well as some schools in Chicago. We were interested in how socioeconomic status affects the brain's ability to represent auditory information. And what we found was that adolescents who came from lower SES backgrounds, that the way that their brains represented sound was fundamentally different from their more privileged counterparts. So we found that their brain's ability to represent sound was weaker, and we saw this in a number of ways. The responses were more variable, so they changed more over time, even though the sound did not change. And there was more noise in the brain. So it was as if there was static in the brain.
So let's try to pull apart exactly why this is happening. Is a conclusion perhaps that in a lower socioeconomic category, you're bombarded with more sound, that indeed you hear different things in your environment, therefore you develop an ability to process sound differently?
Yeah, I think that's one possibility. We believe that it may be a cocktail of factors. I think malnutrition is one major issue, and that could begin as early as prenatally. That could compromise how the auditory system develops. Another factor may be linguistic impoverishment, so not hearing as many words or as complex words may be fundamentally changing how the auditory system develops. A third factor that I think is most relevant to the discussion today is that if you grow up in a poor neighborhood, you're more likely to be exposed to environmental noise. So you may be in a more densely populated area. You're maybe more likely to be near a railroad or near airplane traffic. And exposure to noise can increase your stress levels. That's quite clear. It increases your cortisol levels. It can compromise your ability to read, to perform complex cognitive tasks. And more recently, work has been shown that even low-level noise, noise that isn't necessarily traumatic to your ability to hear in the immediate run, that in the long run, if you have sustained continuous exposure to noise, that this can cause neural degeneration. So you see the brain decline in response to increased noise exposure.
And of course, you know, as we've been hearing today, there are other potential developmental problems with growing up in poverty, developmental problems that really do have to do an awful lot with levels of stress. What's interesting about what you're saying, though, is it would seem in many ways that the brain might be stimulated in a positive way by having to deal with so much input, by having to deal with so many factors of things going on in life, more sounds, more noise, more different people. But you seem to be suggesting maybe the opposite is true.
Yeah, it could be true. I mean, I think a lot of what we're talking about today is kind of the double-edged sword of neuroplasticity. The fact that your brain is so plastic can be both a good thing and it can also be a very bad thing. It can make the brain more vulnerable to impoverishment, to these stressors. So just having more stimulation in your environment isn't necessarily a good thing if you don't know what you're supposed to be paying attention to. What are the important sounds, the important, what's really important that you should be pulling out from your environment?
So in the last couple of minutes that we have, what are some things we can do to maybe reverse this trend? Is there any way to treat some of the things that you're learning about?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways. I think one is to use technology to try and improve the environment. So there's a project going on. It's a fairly innovative project that's starting up in Providence called Providence Talks. And they are using these small devices called a wordometer as a way of tracking the number of words that a kid is hearing in the home environment. And parents are then given periodic reports of the types of linguistic stimulation that their child is receiving. And then they're also provided with coaching as to how they could improve the words, the kinds of words that their kid is hearing. I think there are other types of auditory enrichments that could be considered. I'm a big proponent of music education as well as bilingual education as possible ways of enriching the enriching one's auditory environment and in the process creating a stronger, more resilient brain. The work that I've done in musicians has shown that musicians have more robust neural responses to sound. So if they're listening to sounds in a noisy environment, it's as if there's less noise in the environment.
You know, we just have a little bit of time left. You're nodding your head at all this. This is fascinating to some
of
the work you're doing.
Fascinating, absolutely. It's wonderful to hear about people doing work in the details of what could actually be done to break these cycles.
Well, and one thing I'll say is to get to an earlier caller's point as we run a little low on time here. You know, we talk a lot about education. I think the point being made was that we're trying to educate people out of poverty in many ways by giving them the skills necessary to get a good job in order to move on. But things like this, the idea that music, therapy, education might actually reverse some trends in the way your brain develops, that might make a signal that maybe arts education is a really important part of how we get people out of poverty in the future. We'll have to leave it there. And I want to thank Erica Skoy for sharing some of her research with us. She's assistant professor in the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at UConn. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you also to Kathleen Weldon, who's research manager for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at UConn. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank Tess Aronson, who helped us produce today's program. Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives are the producers of Where We Live. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Paul called in and said he wanted to mention that St. Mark's Episcopal Church in New Britain hosts a Conversations on Poverty on September 26th. Go to WNPR.org for more information. This is Where We Live.